Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Monday, July 14th, 2003. Today's session is The Economists versus the Theologians. Session 1 of Capitalism, the New Age Religion, presented by Yetta Odgaard Nash. The number is NAJ2003-01. Let's listen in.
I'm from Denmark, so if my English sometimes gets a little funny, it's, you know why. I took my Norwegian equivalent of a master's, I think it would be, at the University of Oslo in theology, in the field that we call systematic theology. So even if I'm probably going to be the most unsystematic systematic theology, that's the way it is. I want to start by saying that when I talk about capitalism, I'm not necessarily saying that we're in need of another economic model, but that I think we need to talk about it in a more honest way or find a different vocabulary that reveals more about what this model is all about. I'd like to begin with sharing what, or for us to share, what is our conception or understanding of what is an economist and what is a theologian, because that's going to, we're going to use that later on in the session to see, talk about the language of an economist and the language of a theologian and see if maybe sometimes they're not so far apart. So if anyone wants to open with some, like a brainstorming, what do you think about, what is it that comes to mind about the methodology, the key words for an economist?
One that changes their minds.
Changes their minds, okay. Change of mind.
Well, they create models of human behavior.
Predictions.
I think of an economist as a theorist.
Sorry?
A theorist.
And their outlook, they come from what we would call, they have scientific, it's supposed to be rational. You know, they look in facts and then they come up with some model for us. That's really good. And then the theologian. If anyone has some keywords that you think of when you think of a theologian. Could someone maybe pull the shirt aside?
I guess I'm blind to this.
I'm like... A theologian, nothing really. What about spirituality?
Language about God.
Interpretation.
I think theorists as well.
Okay. So when we talk about the economist, we think something scientific, rational, built on mathematical facts that we expect to be solid knowledge. Am I pretty much? First, I forgot to. I want to apologize for not having many books here, that my quotations are going to be a little from my desk that my husband had been having his bag. And my books are all in a boat going north from Brazil or in a bag with my parents in Denmark, so yeah, I know that's the lousy 6 years ago. It's just the way it is. I'd like to look at what some economists have said about the model we know as capitalism or free market economy. And keep in mind what we just have said about their methodology. The economists I've chosen for this presentation are chosen because they're all main characters in the sort of world of political economy. I'm not saying that they're the only ones or even the best, but they're pretty well known. The first one is F.A. Hayek. He died in 1992, but is still used in most business schools and economic courses. He was a Nobel Prize winner in economics in 1974, and well, people call him the grandfather of today's neoliberal economic theory. As a European, my use of the word liberal is probably a little different from the American use of liberal. It means right-wing, conservative, more of a Republican image than in the States. Liberal is pretty much the opposite, as I understood. So, Bishu, when I say liberal, I mean the European. Otherwise,
that's good to
really
define, yeah.
Otherwise, we're really going to get confused.
Yeah.
Hayek is, as I said, he's still very much studied. His most famous book, I think, is The Road to Serfdom from 1944, which is still being republished. I think the last came out in 92 or... And he has a collection called Law, Legislation and Liberty, a new statement of the liberal principles of the justice and political economy. And it was published in its full in 1982. In the latter, the collection, he argues that the consequences of the free market is in accordance to, and this is a quotation, natural law. Does any of you have, what do you think when you hear natural law?
Survival of the fittest.
Yeah. Something built into nature.
Gravity.
It's kind of, if we talk about Hegel, the philosopher, he talked about some things built in, like natural, inherent into our, the world history or... And when I say natural law, does any one of you think very much of rationality or factual theories? Or I'm just thinking, to me, it sounds more like the opposite.
Sounds like religion.
Yeah. And he says, among other things, that whatever unfavorable consequences the politics of the free market has, they were not planned for, and so forth, no one can be held responsible for them. This doesn't sound very rational to me either. It's just a question, does it sound like the free market is something that has just created itself?
Yes.
Something that is, built into nature, that was bound to emerge for us sooner or later. He also has a theory. He's very involved in what he calls individual rights or individual justice. And that doesn't mean that there is justice for the individual, but it means that no individual can be held responsible for the effects of an institution. It sounds kind of like modern politics going bad.
Well, it's an important principle because illegally businesses want to be considered people, but the people that run and own the businesses don't want to be held accountable for the actions of the businesses.
Yes.
And so it's a way of avoiding personal responsibility.
Yes.
that's the base. That's the
that's
thinking that created the basis for those legal arguments.
Yeah, I think maybe for an American, it's easier to understand individual rights and for European or especially a Scandinavian growing up in a social, democratic, welfare society. I sometimes have a little trouble understanding all this joy of individual. The other economist that I'm going to talk about just shortly is Francis Fukuyama. I think many people heard of him. He's written a lot of books. The most famous one is The End of History and the Last Man. Anyone read that? He's written a lot of books on different sociological and economic issues. He is, at least last time I checked, he was the Dean of Faculty and Bernard L. Schwartz Professor of International Political Economy at Paul H. Mitzer School of Advanced International Studies at the Johns Hopkins University of Washington, D.C. So this is a guy who should really be in prison. He has, among other things, been the advisor of policy for the Reagan government. He analyzed a Western liberal political history in his book, The End of History and the Last Man. And he is very Hegelian, if that means anything to you. Hegel had a theory of history, sort of like an upgoing spiral, if I've understood it correctly. And we get closer and closer to sort of the prime time of history. If Fukuyama doesn't agree with, or he doesn't use this model on all aspects of modern society, but for the when we come to the political and economic model that we're using today in the Western world, this is how he reads it. And this model, or this upgoing spiral, he concludes that the liberal democracy with its capitalistic economic model, the free market, is the apex, is that what I say? Mm-hmm. Of a human process of searching for the inherent ideal administration for a societal economy. And in the quest to answer his own question, whether or not we're at the end of history in the understanding, have we reached sort of the highest level, he turns to Hegel and asks whether man is absolutely satisfied. This was sort of Hegel's, what he based whether or not society was functioning, is man satisfied? Or has many people as possible reached a state of satisfaction? And satisfaction, you can use the other word recognition, was what Hegel would say. If we're recognized, if we feel valued, we're satisfied, and then our system is working. And what I'm thinking is, when I read this, that who is the audience for these texts? Is the audience 500 other economists sitting in the same room where this speech was given, or who is he talking to? And that is what the theologians that we'll talk about a little later has a lot of reaction towards. Who is not counted into this satisfaction model? I think these examples show how two leading economists have built their theories on the assumption that the capitalistic economic model is some sort of a natural phenomenon. And something humanity was bound to discover as the model that would lead to human satisfaction. And I was just wondering, do you see any potential dangers in this kind of view towards an economic model? Would you have any reaction to a model that's...
Satisfaction for who? Would that be a question?
Yeah.
It's difficult to be critical of something if you think it's the natural order. And so it kind of takes care of the critical voice.
I was kind of thinking that I am the true Holden spirit, and I was just a hike. I want us to go over for 10 minutes to the, I think it's the community building, and look at the photos that they have placed over there to sort of lead us into talking about the Latin American theologians that I have chosen to indicate more of what their reality looks like with 35,000 children dying, was it, every day. So if we could do that, I think that would be good.
If they are Christ-centered in their thinking to begin with, based on the natural law that you talked about, which is God's law, that would be a different scenario than if you took...
I don't necessarily see natural law as God, I mean, God's law, God, who we usually talk about.
You're maybe thinking more of
a natural force of greed.
That the natural thing for a non-Christian would be greed, and that would drive him to in his economy and his way of making money.
Do you think greed is only for non-Christians?
No.
I think it's
a little greed is good. But you have to be benevolent at the same time and give money and take care of the poor.
Well, there's a fine line, I think, between greed and being ambitious in anything you do. But one you do for self and one you do for others.
So when Hayek says, we don't really need to think about other people. If everybody just thought about themselves, society would work. How do you really?
I don't think so.
It would never work. It's never
because worked. That's why the African or the Latin people, their leader is stealing all the money from them, and they're in poverty, and he's living in riches.
But I just need to say something. What about, I mean, I think my leader in Denmark is not a whole lot better. What is your reaction to some of your own leaders?
Let's back up one, because, I mean, I'll have a reaction for this based on economy. And that is, Clinton, pushed very hard for some things like GATT and NAFTA, which I oppose. Because they do something which is, I think, is concentrating the wealth amongst the international corporations and the wealthiest people in the world. And I think it is a kind of organized economic exploitation of world workers. And that we can't look at it as our country and that country and that country. We're living in a globalized economy in which the major players, whether it's Bill Clinton, and I take Clinton just because I happen to be a supporter of it, you know, on some issues, but economically, I think those things were horrible for U.S. labor and for labor in South America. And so that's an answer to your question.
I think the difference in our country, there's opportunity for political leaders to make up quite well personally, but it's not in such stark contrast because we have a middle class. So we get sort of disgusted or offended sometimes when people do that and use their power to personally benefit when there's less to go around and more is hoarded. Then there's such a contrast. But I think the same processes work for political leaders wherever they are. I mean, Vaclav Havel wrote a great book called The Art of the Impossible about the nature of politics and what it was like to go from being a playwright to the president of the country, and about the dynamics that he faced. Even a guy like him, who wasn't really looking for anything, was constantly being offered things and pulled towards money and power that would benefit him, but not his people, and it was a real struggle for him to not sort of get impacted. affected by that.
And that was kind of like a natural law. If you get in a certain position, those things just come to you.
They're gonna happen.
And you can't, and you didn't do anything, it just happened.
You're the temptation will be there.
But at the same time, he probably wasn't, you know, tithing and giving to the poor. I don't know.
Not the Bible? Sure.
He made what?
But I think the difference between, say, a leader in the U.S. Congress and the leader of some of the countries we saw pictures of there is that they both have the power to sort of change the situation. But the leader in the U.S. Congress has a chance to stand up and set the terms of change because we have so much more power. Whereas the leader of a small country has no idea how long their power is going to last, how much time they have to, if they're inclined to take money. And sometimes it's there, you know, the Egyptian debt was built by leaders who really wanted to improve the country. They wanted to build the Aswan Dam, they wanted to westernize the country, and as a result had a huge debt and a lot of electricity, but not enough jobs.
And I think if you, for example, read the book Joseph Stiglitz, I think his name is, Globalization and its Discontents, you'll see, or he argues, he was the, he worked for the, what is the, World Bank, is that what you're doing? And he argues that through his work he got insight in this, how we do the loaning and how the World Bank and the World Monetary Foundation works. And many of these small countries really don't have all that much power about what goes on in their own countries. So I'm not denying that there is corruption. There's a lot of corruption in Brazil, for example. But it's not the only force that's working. I'll go on to the theologians. Start talking. I lived in Brazil for 3 years, and during that time I got to read several theologians within the methodology or movement that we call liberation theology. How many of you have heard of that? I think it started in the 60s, was part of sort of the left-wing movement that went on in most parts of the world, and the methodology, I've been told, started when Catholic priests moved out into the shanty towns, or the favelas, as they call them in Brazil, and lived with the poor, and suddenly they were asked all new kinds of questions that the old theology didn't really address, like poverty and why aren't we doing anything about it? Why can't the church actually help us? Yeah. Praying is good, and we'll do it together, but we don't only need, you know, the paradise that's to come, but we need action now. So a great part of the liberation theology is that action is an integrated part of the methodology. You need reflection of society, what's going on in society. You need biblical interpretation and help from reading the text, and then you have the practical part. You have this triangle or circle that you need all the elements to have a valid theology. And their key word was option for the poor, that God, we're all God's people, but he has a special preference for the economically poor. And it's in this line of the theology that these two theologians sort of has come out of. Liberation theology is modernizing. It's moving in a different direction. It's moving in indigenous liberation theology, in ecological direction, in all sorts of very interesting the ologies are coming out of it. And we have it, I think, here, African-American liberation theology, indigenous, and just very interesting to see what's, you know, the theological landscape is moving. And the first theologian I want to talk about is Jung Woo Sung. Doesn't sound very Latin. He immigrated from South Korea more than 30 years ago, and he's now a professor of theology at two universities in Sao Paulo. Everybody knows it's a major city, 17 to 20 million people live there. And one is a Catholic university and the other is a Methodist. And the other person I want to talk about is Julio de Santa Ana. He's from Uruguay. And I'm not sure what he's doing now, but until recently he's been a professor at Bossi Ecumenical Institute in Switzerland, which is run by the church council, I think. It's an ecumenical meeting place, and he was in charge of a think tank there, or, you know, to start developing new research there. And they bring their Latin American experience and perspectives to the international political economy. And especially they like to deal with Fukuyama and Hayek and Milton Friedman, I think most people know from the School of Economics at Chicago. And they use a variation of approaches, and one of them is that they look at how the economists use religious myths and symbols and metaphors, what one could call a metaphorical distortion of religious myths, or as an American fellow of yours, Jon Gunnemann from Candler School of Theology at Emory University, he said there is a metaphorical exchange between religion and economy. He sees this exchange as going both ways. In religion, there is a lot of use of economic terms, like debt and all sorts of terms that we use. And as that way, he sees it going more back and forth. But I'm not going to go into that other use. Jung Woo Sung said that he acknowledges that economy is a strange and difficult field to enter for a non-economist. And but in spite of the obstacles for a theologian or a layperson, it is imperative that we confront our economic situation. Considering the option for the poor, he says that we have to learn and teach where God is in the middle of the current economic situation, which is again come from liberation theology. We need to be answering or dealing with some of the questions that are being asked by the poor and by all of us, because we all live in this economic situation. An economic analysis serves to describe the logic in the economic process, but it does not demask the idol and reveal the spirit. That is the task of theology. And that is why he thinks that theology has to enter, because we have other things that we can contribute. I think the titles of two of his books will all stand by themselves as something to think about for a moment. One is God in an Economy Without Heart, a Challenge to Evangelism. And is from 92, and from 91 is The Idolatry of Capital and the Death of the Poor. Does anyone have any? I think they're very not aggressive, but quite harsh titles.
Read the first one.
God in an Economy Without Heart, a Challenge to Evangelism.
Is the second one talking about the idea that we don't see the poor? That the poor are invisible?
That's implicit. He talks about that too. He talks about how our economic model or what we value has changed. And I'm going to give some examples, more concrete examples. We've already looked at why theology should engage in this discussion, listening to what Jung Muslim says. And he says, because the structuring of capitalism is an idolatry of the market, it is of theological importance. What it says directly and indirectly about human beings is contrary to the Christian idea of humans created in the image of God, each with a unique value in their mere being. So he says that the idea of the market economy and what lies behind it, he sees as against our Christian values.
Could I put that in just kind of, I need concrete things sometimes to talk about that. A way I would do that is like in our free market is how we reward a baseball player compared to a preschool teacher, you know, how we value that in money. Is that what you were saying there? I mean, is that's the idea that came to mind?
Yeah, it's a part of it. It's a part of it, and it talks about what you say and what you said before about who is the audience, who is a member of the society when we talk about the free market. Who is the free market, or who is the free market if we take it as sort of an institution interested in? Who are valuable members of the free market?
White, upper middle class, educated.
Those with capital.
Yeah.
Those who have the most.
So that leaves out how many people and who?
5 billion. And it's not to say that sports, that baseball player, basketball player, a lot of those guys are starting their own foundations and giving it to the poor. They have their own little area that they want to concentrate. I mean, the black people are probably trying to educate black kids and help them out.
But the word was little.
Little.
Yeah. They have their little thing.
Well, but if they didn't have the money, they wouldn't be doing anything. But they got the money, so they can probably do. And how do you know? How do you know how little they're doing? I mean,
I think the bigger question, though, is the one you asked, which is not so much what do people, like basketball players, do with their money, but what set of values are in place. And what sort of economy do we have in place where the people who shape the future by shaping the way preschoolers think, which has everything to do with how they'll behave as adults, get paid versus the way entertainers, which is basketball players and other entertainers or singers or actors or anyone like that, are paid. And there's, you know, there's value in the arts, and entertainment's a form of arts, but that, you know, how wide should that be? If you want to apply values in a free market economy, it's whatever the market will bear. And because television and advertising will bear a lot, there's a lot of money to be had if you're a very good basketball player.
And it's because the American public is willing to spend the money for the tickets and buy the product and pump that whole system.
Right. And not conversely willing to spend. Because you don't need any advertising revenue. It's hard to generate revenue out of preschool. So the revenue from that comes either, you know, from the people who pay for it, which often are paying because they have to go to work for probably not a job that pays a ton, or the public at large, you know.
But don't you think that preschool teachers getting a fair wage? I mean, what's fair?
No, I'm just asking the question. So a free market sets this up, but if we say that's fine, then we've said something about our values. If we say, actually, we think the people who shape the way children think and therefore the way they behave are just as important as entertainers and sports figures who entertain us, then what would we do to change that?
But I think that it's not really the that what he's criticizing is not, I think, the individuals in the different in the economic model, but I think he would say, what do we really want, a society where some people are dependent on charity? Or why don't we? I think he is striving for a model where everybody is a valid member. And of course it means for them to be able to buy food and the necessary things, but it doesn't necessarily mean that
But you're trying to structure everything and it's not free any longer. And the communists tried that and it didn't work. Now, I don't know if they maybe followed it up, but it didn't work.
It depends on what we think free is.
And for whom?
Yeah, and are we all supposed to be free? And what does that freedom mean when it's about responsibility for one another?
Well, those things are kind of
built
into the system.
I think it depends on where you fit into the system.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're the minority in this country, and the system benefits us. I mean, we were talking earlier about neoliberal economics, and a lot of that's about globalization, where our standards are what we think is good for corporate multinationals, a lot of them American-based, which are good for our stock market and good for us, are devastating to the economies of other countries and to the people there. And we say, yeah, the system's working great because we're on the receiving end of the system. And if we want to be critical of it, at the same time, we have to be willing to say, I'm going to give up these benefits and be proactive, because otherwise, no, it's like you say, we're participating. We're paying for the $60 tickets to go to the ball game and things like that and supporting those economies.
One of the bridles, or one of the things that limits the freedom of an investor or a company, is taxes. And so if one of the things that limits the freedom of an individual working person is, for instance, if I have a job that is not a job where I'm fulfilled, but I have health insurance, I'd rather be doing something maybe a better deed than the job that I'm doing, but I'm kind of locked into that, but I've got three children. So I'm locked into that that job because it's got health insurance, because if I quit it, there isn't health insurance. With a different tax structure in this country, we could have health insurance for all, but that would limit the freedom of a different set of people. So yeah. So it's that the question of whose freedom are we talking about, I think, is.
And at the same time, your country probably tried that, and I don't know if it worked or not. The socialistic health insurance for everyone.
I think it works.
It worked good.
It still works.
It still works. We pay taxes, and everybody has. We can go to the doctor. We don't have to pay. We can go to the hospital. We don't have to worry about when my cancer has cost my insurance company $200,000, I have to go home. It's not perfect. Sometimes we have to wait for 2 months to get our scanning, and that's, a lot of Danes complain about that. But in general, I would say it works.
But so your freedom to switch jobs isn't impacted at all by whether or not you'll have health insurance. So in
freedom,
that case, Your freedom is increased because others, including yourself, are encumbered in the way of taxation.
I think what I see as freedom not to worry, mm-hmm, about my kids going to college or all sorts of things. But I think different nations are willing to accept different kinds of limitations on their freedom, and we look at freedom as different things. And I think that's what in itself discussion. But what I think is is important for Jung Musung is that because of the way that we have created, or that we have created an economic model that doesn't create much freedom, because the world is bigger than our little house, or the world involves people like people in the photos that we saw.
Is your country, does the government own all the businesses and jobs?
No.
They don't. There is such a thing as private.
Yeah, you can say
just
it's
through taxation that they're getting.
I mean, they have the majority of the postal system, and they own the hospitals, and there's a lot of Danish companies that are also on the stock.
How does the medical system work there? And what's the incentive for some of the doctors there? Do they go someplace else if they want to excel?
Their incentive is that they're doctors and they work at a hospital. I mean, and that shows how difficult it is to us for understanding a Brazilian theologian, because within us in the West, we have such different thinking that we can hardly talk to each other. I know we can, but it's fortunately because I speak English.
But can I get back? Because I do think our level of entitlement almost makes us blind to the rest of the world. I mean, our sense that we deserve, that we have a right.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of inventive needs here.
A huge piece of the world's energy and goods. I mean, we really get up in the morning.
24% we use.
Yeah, we're blind. I mean, those photographs, might give us an inkling that somehow we have some responsibility for those 30,000 kids that are dying every day. But we really don't think that that has anything to do with the oil we're sucking out, or the goods that were taken out of Central America, or the fact that we supported Noriega all those years, or the way that we've manipulated the Game Boy, right? We are not responsible for those kids dying. And we refuse to believe it. And until we do, they will be invisible. And until we do, see them, we can't act, from our soul. I mean, you can't be free if you believe so strongly that you're so entitled to your toaster and your car and oil that you don't have a responsibility to other people in the world. You can't do it.
But would it make the world a better place if we got rid of our cars and we didn't use any gas? I mean, is that going to correct the situation? What are you going to do?
Do we have to leap to that, or do we have to say first, are there children dying because of our actions?
But is it because of that the children are dying? Or is it that nobody, that the people that are getting paid, those countries are getting money from the extraction of the oil?
No.
But what are they doing? The corporations. What did Saddam Hussein do with the money he got?
We don't
see
them.
We don't see them.
We don't see them because we believe we're entitled. That's where we have to start.
We see them as a photograph.
I knew having failure would keep the focus somehow. No, I think it's not about what Saddam Hussein, or to me, it's not about what Saddam Hussein did to some money in Iraq, or it's not about your car is not going to kill any children in Afghanistan unless they happen to pass by. But it's the division of goods on a global level that we all have to take responsibility for, I think, is what Jung was saying.
One way that our gas use would be related to some children would be if we're using the gas and they can't use it for irrigation, I think that would be a kind of a direct relationship. But
in the final analysis, when God looks at it, is he going to judge nations or is he going to judge individuals? So we have to act as individuals.
The Old Testament's pretty full of God judging nations.
but he's going to, when he says, every knee shall bow. And it doesn't talk about nations in the New Testament.
Yeah, he does talk about
so
how I care about
the Christ-centered thing. If we were Christ-centered, we wouldn't be greedy. We would each one of us be doing what we're supposed to do to help our fellow man.
Mm-hmm. But I think...
But because we have rules and laws and things like the basketball player, you know, in this country, he is penalized because he makes a lot of money. So automatically he's taxed 50% and that goes back to the government. And he, you know, somewhere along the line, somebody gets some of that money anyway in that total economy, free economy.
I think that a lot of not that
that basketball player
like
cares anything
like
about
that
he's I'm sorry.
I think a lot of Latin Americans would like to be penalized like that baseball player.
Mm-hmm.
With how many millions a year?
Yeah, it's crazy. I have to agree with you.
Or
but if that money didn't get put into the coffers, why would the country be able to help all these other countries?
They're not.
Oh, there's $15 billion just going to Africa.
The overall aid package
to
Africa
was cut.
It's a tiny percentage.
But what other countries stepping up to the plate and doing that?
But that money's not going there to help. That's debt.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll tell you, when I was a teenager, my father was recruited. He's an agricultural expert. He was recruited to go to Egypt for USAID, which until that time, I was really proud that our country had a whole division of government devoted to, called Agency for International Development. And my father took a lot of pride in taking a leave of absence from the university to go do that, because he thought it's a way he could do his part to help the Egyptians improve their agriculture. And as we prepared to go, my father had visited a couple times, and we had a brand new Chevy Malibu station wagon with a $500 stereo, and I think it's supposed to back then. And he, no way was he sending that through Egyptian customs, because it was going to come out with very few of the parts we started with. So he had visited, though, and he said to the project leader, well, for the cost that it will cost the U.S. government to ship my car to Egypt and back, I can lease a car in Egypt and a driver, which, if you've ever been to Cairo, is not a bad idea. And he was told, no, you will not. You will ship a car, and you will ship it on one of the following three shipping companies' tabs. They were all American companies. So he did that, and we were told we had to ship all our stuff. We couldn't buy anything there. Of substance, shipped everything, and he bought an old, broken-down Fiat that worked because he knew there was Fiat repairmen there. And there was an event. This all came out of the Camp David Accords. So the ambassador came to this event and looked at our Fiat and just had a fit. He wanted to be, whose Fiat is in the driveway? Mm-hmm. There should be an American car in that driveway. This is when we're still on the illusions there was American cars and Japanese cars. But Fiat, pretty safe bet that it wasn't me. And my father was punished for not buying a GM Ford Chevy car and paying it. The cost was $12,000. This was in 1980, $12,000 to ship the car there and ship it back. When we were done, we intended to leave the Fiat to somebody who would need it. We would not allow that. The U.S. government paid another $10,000. This was a $2,000 Fiat to ship it back. This is all part of that debt.
Mm-hmm.
This was all to help the Egyptians. And the whole point of the whole project was, yeah, my dad was there. He met with some farmers, basically figured out they'd been sold a lot of tractors that were useless to them. Their agriculture had worked for thousands of years. They'd been undone and become dependent upon tractors made by John Deere and the National Harvester, which didn't work. You know, they would break down, and you know, they didn't have a whole lot of mechanics there who would run around and fix things for food. So there was people not eating. But thousands and thousands of dollars were spent on my family. The U.S. government spent $20,000 for me to go to 10th grade and for my sister to go to first grade because we were supposed to go to American school. Which, and all of that account was run through American banks. The whole setup was, it was aid to Egypt, and there was some benefit that came out of it in terms of research. But the vast majority of the money spent that became debt to Egypt was spent for U.S. companies to ship my family back and forth. So I think we need to be careful when we think we're helping people.
But we need to change our leaders then.
Yeah.
And get some of those crazy policies adjusted, but that's where that has to start. That's something we can do internally.
The whole U.S. foreign policy is based on providing economic opportunity for U.S. companies. That don't fool yourselves. Mm-hmm. The whole aid package to Iraq that we have now is based on that. The Enron scandal that has abused North Americans so horrendously has a partner in Brazil, AES, which is abusing the Brazilian people. And almost everybody in Latin America has higher energy bills now because USA insists that they work with certain companies. U.S. aid policy insists that they work with certain companies. And so they're paying more for their energy. And the same way that North Americans are footing the bill for more higher energy costs as a result of dishonest policies. The same kind of corruption you talked about in Africa and Latin America is happening in the United States, and we continue to elect the same leaders, the same kinds of leaders.
I'm afraid I have to stop the discussion here. I think tomorrow I'll just leave theologians at home and just talk. I'm sorry I wasn't able to hold you in a tighter leash, but maybe tomorrow.
Give it a shot.
Thank you.